Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Politics. I'm Tim Jones, and I'm talking today to Sehi Plukhi about the Russo-Ukrainian War, published in May by Alan Lane. Acclaimed by the Financial Times as the world's foremost historian of Ukraine, Professor Plukhi is the author of, among other things, the prize-winning Chernobyl, History of a Tragedy, a sweeping history of Ukraine called The Gates of Europe, and a new history of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Nuclear Folly. His new book concludes with this prediction: the Ukrainian nation will emerge from this war more united and certain of its identity than at any other point in its modern history. Moreover, Ukraine's successful resistance to Russian aggression is destined to promote Russia's own nation-building project. Russia and its elites now have little choice but to reimagine their country's identity by parting ways not only with the imperialism of the Tsarist past, but also with the anachronistic model of a Russian nation consisting of Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians. Sehi Plukhi is the Mykhailo Ryshevsky Professor of Ukrainian History at Harvard and Director of the University's Ukrainian Research Institute. Sehi, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Well, you begin your book, this new book on the war, by deliberately misquoting Churchill as saying the historians are the worst interpreters of current events except everyone else. When you said that, I remembered something Eric Edelman said 6 months into the war. He said that, why is it that historians have done a better job of explaining this conflict than Russian military experts? So do you agree with that? And is that what you meant by your Churchillism?
Well, what I meant was that sometime during the first week of the war, I discovered that people kept turning to me for commentary and analysis. And a lot of these questions were about history, about the road to the war. And I was surprised, but I responded positively to this request because I thought that I could, if people are interested, this is my chance somehow to help to deal with this situation intellectually, emotionally, and otherwise. And that convinced me that not just I, but we historians as a whole had something to say. And that something is a historical perspective. Normally, our wisdom as historians comes from the fact that we are commenting on Monday on the game that was played on Sunday, and we know already the result. And that perspective gives us power. But I realized something that they didn't know before in the last year and a half, that even the game is still going on. Knowing history, knowing where it started, no background of the people on the field really helps you to not only understand what is happening now, but also to a degree predict the outcome, not the immediate outcome, but long-term outcome, not maybe the outcome of the game, but certainly the results of the season.
Well, before we come to the history, you give a very personal introduction to the book where you talk about how you were when the invasion began and how you felt. Can you talk us through that?
I was not in Ukraine at the time when war started. I wasn't in the United States where I live now and teach. I was on sabbatical in Vienna. And as news were piling up about the potential war, major war coming to Ukraine, I had this really associations going back to World War II. And of course, Vienna was at the center of this early story of the Anschluss. Vienna was also at the center of the story of the part of World War I. So those parallels were there for me. But still, deep down, I hoped that the war would not happen, or at least would not happen on that level. And I had long discussions with my colleagues, including this one of my colleagues at Harvard. And on the early morning in Vienna of February 24, 2022, I opened my email and I saw a headline, not headline, but the subject line of the email. And it was, my goodness, those were the words which were in the subject line. And before even opening the email, I already knew that it began. And it's a strange feeling. On the one hand, as a historian, you look at these preparations, you comment on that, you comment on different options. So intellectually, you are maybe half prepared, but emotionally, certainly I wasn't. I wasn't even 5% prepared for what happened.
So what's central to the book and to your explanation for the war is the idea set out in the quotes I cited at the beginning, where you talk about, quote, the Russian nation consisting of Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians, this thing that instills Russian nationalism or Russian imperialist nationalism. Can you take us through the history of how that developed and became such a core of that kind of thinking in Russia?
The 19th century, that's where it all started and began. And this is the time, not just in the history of Russian Empire, but really the history of Europe and the history of the world, when empires, as I write in my book, encounter an enemy that they can't defeat. And the name of that enemy is, at that time, liberal nationalism. So the rise of national movements, the foundation, intellectual, cultural foundations for the new modern states have been formed. And the Russian Empire was not an exception from the general rule. So they started to somehow fight against this, recognizing early on what a danger it is to the empire. They started to fight against those movements. And a response to the Ukrainian, modern Ukrainian national movement that comes in the 1840s was 20 years later, by 1860s, formulation and idea that, yes, maybe Ukrainians speak differently than Russians, maybe they dance differently, but at the end of the day, they're all Russians. And the model was introduced of the three-partite Russian nation, a very imperial model, where the great Russians or Russians, the Ukrainians or little Russians, and the white Russians or Belarusians constituted one big group, a Russian imperial nation that would be the core of the empire and its transformation to this new national era, to the new age of all of nations. And that concept was very important, very influential up until the World War I. And then it collapsed in the middle of the World War I, collapsed in the middle of the revolution. And the Bolsheviks, who came to power in the former Russian Empire, were able to really bring together the empire and stitch it back with the help of course, military force and brutality, but also with the help of new internationalist ideology, communism. And they at least provided a formal recognition to Ukrainians and Belarusians as separate nations. And the independent Ukrainian state, after being defeated by Bolshevik Russia, was integrated into the Soviet Union as a Union Republic. Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. The same happened with Belarus. And what we have today, and you can see that from the pronouncements of Vladimir Putin, from the ideology, overall ideology of the war, that Russians and Ukrainians are one and the same people, meaning that Ukrainians don't exist. So you see in all of that return to the old, outdated imperialist visions of Russia itself, Russian nation, but also imperialist visions of dealing with the rise of national identity. So it's almost like Russia of 21st goes back to the Russia of 19th century and tries to fix the challenge that comes with national self-determination of the former imperial spaces by using 19th century tools, which is quite bizarre, but the fact that it is bizarre doesn't make it less tragic if you look at the news coming from Ukraine.
Yeah, you say, you talked about how the Bolsheviks gave some autonomy to these other republics. And of course, Putin has used this as to support a claim that Lenin was the creator of the modern Ukrainian state. But you argue with this in the book. Why is that?
I wanted to say a few words about the term argue, because it goes to the core of the reaction that was to the publication of that essay by Putin that was called the On Historical Unity of Russians and Ukrainians. And in the academic circles that I'm part of, it was basically perceived as ridicule in terms of the argument, in terms of the use of the historical facts. And there were long discussions among us whether actually something like that deserves a response. Because once you start arguing with that, you are providing the other side with the sort of legitimacy, academic legitimacy, that probably other side doesn't deserve under the circumstances. So I'm not arguing against what is being said in that article. I didn't argue back then. I'm not arguing today. But what I want to say is that the response to this vision of Russia and Ukraine can be provided and is provided not only in discussions and in historical works, but also it was provided on the battlefield in Ukraine. Very much this war, its first start and its operations, was based on the idea that Russians and Ukrainians were one and the same people. So in that sense, the argument on Putin's side was not just historical, it was something that he believed in existed in today's world, where the Ukrainians were actually deep down Russians who were misled by the bunch of nationalist Nazis and drug addicts led by President Volodymyr Zelensky. And I'm not making up these terms and words, that they're all in the official pronouncements, Russian official pronouncements. So the expectation was that good Russians in Ukraine would welcome the Russian troops entering the country with flowers, and they met them with weapons, and keep fighting back. That's for me the argument is the right term. That's an argument in its own right.
In your history, you make it very clear how pivotal Ukraine was to the collapse of the Soviet Union, and you quote Boris Yeltsin just being unable to accept that this was a possibility, that the Ukrainians were voting in their referendum to leave the Soviet Union. Can you talk us through that? Why it was so important to the future of the USSR that Ukraine was the main republic that brought it down?
Well, the Soviet Union was dissolved 1 week after the Ukrainian referendum. Referendum took place on December 1st, 1991, anywhere between 80 and 85% of the eligible voters took part in the referendum. 92% voted for independence. So it was quite a decisive outcome. But the trick was that Ukrainians didn't answer in the referendum question was not about the future of the Soviet Union. The referendum question was about whether Ukraine, whether the citizens of Ukraine wanted their, at that time, Union Republic, Soviet Union Republic, to become independent. But the outcome was the fall of the USSR. And Ukraine was the only republic in the entire Union that held a referendum on independence. Well, one other held. But Ukraine's vote decided really the fate of Russians, of Kazakhs, of many other groups and nationalities in the Soviet Union. Because neither Yeltsin nor even Gorbachev imagined a continuation of the Soviet project, I mean Union project, without Ukraine. And there are there is a number of reasons for that. One of them is that Ukraine used to be the second largest after Russia republic of the Soviet Union in terms of population and economic output. So economically, for Russia to continue with the project of the Soviet Union, which in 1990-91 considered the project that required the sort of money that Russia didn't have. So economically, for Yeltsin to continue with the Union project would be a major problem. That's even if you forget about really not happy relationships between Yeltsin and Gorbachev. But there was also another important factor, and that was the cultural proximity, ethnic, linguistic, religious of Russians and Ukrainians, because Russians and Ukrainians are not one nation, not one people, but they belong in the mind of linguists and historians to the category called Eastern Slavs. Historically, the origins of both countries are in Kyiv, the capital of today's Ukraine, religion, the Orthodox or Eastern Christian religion, is shared by the majority of population of Russia and majority of the population in Ukraine, is certainly the factor that made Ukraine an important factor in terms of both Soviet history and post-Soviet history. And Yeltsin more than once told President George H.W. Bush of the United States at that time that without Ukraine, Russia would be, as he put it, outvoted, outnumbered in the Soviet Union dominated by Central Asian republics, which by definition were not East Slavic or Slavic at all, and were not Christian, to say nothing about, in terms of the majority of their population, to say nothing about East Christian. So all of these factors, from economic importance, from the number of the population to the historical proximity of Ukraine to Russia, really contributed to the fact that once Ukrainians voted no to the Soviet Union, Russia lost interest in the project, and then the rest of the republics followed, and the Soviet Union fell apart within 4 or 5 months after the Ukrainian parliament declared independence, and then 1 week after Ukrainians supported the decision, the parliament, the referendum.
It's funny because they clearly, even then, saw it as temporary. You quote an advisor to Yeltsin as saying that when Russia's back on its feet again, everyone will rally to it and the question of a union can be resolved again. So they never really gave up. And that sort of thinking, I guess, is the origin of where we are now.
I certainly agree with that. I think this is what happened. When the Soviet Union was dissolved, the leaders of the three East Slavic nations, Yeltsin of Russia, Kravchuk of Ukraine, and Shushkevich of Belarus, so those were the East Slavic republics that before the revolution were considered part of the same nation. So the leaders dissolved the Soviet Union. So the the former members of that, participants in that imperial model of the big Russian nation, got together and they dissolved the Soviet Union, not Slavic and non-Slavic leaders and so on and so forth. And this is of course an irony of the situation, but the Commonwealth that they created instead was viewed by Russia as the way to maintain the control of a post-Soviet space. Ukrainians looked differently at that Commonwealth of Independent States. For them, that was, as they put more than once, an instrument for civilized divorce. We know now that the divorce didn't go, ended up to be not civilized at all. But there was, from the very beginning, very different expectations from that organization on part of Russia and Ukraine. And Russia really believed that the republics would come back one day. Even during the first tenure of Vladimir Putin as the president of Russia at the beginning of the century, quite a lot of traction got a project proposed by once his patron and then ally, Anatoly Chubais, who was also one of the liberal advisors to Yeltsin, the author of the Russian privatization program. So Chubais was writing at the beginning of the century about the Russian liberal empire that would be ruled not by force, not by army, but the economic power of Russia and the power of the Russian corporations. That was his vision, a soft empire. But we are talking here about the person who is considered in Russia to be the absolute symbol of liberalism of Yeltsin era. Mm-hmm. There is no really, never was to a degree a disagreement between conservatives and quote unquote liberals that it has had to be a continuing Russian dominance over the region. The question was which empire it would be. The liberals who established and maintained and controlled through the economic means and soft power, or it would be the one that would remind observers about the military empires of the past. And Putin's response eventually, since the start of the war in Georgia in 2008, the annexation of the Crimea in 2014, and now the all-out war in 2022, was the vision of the empire based on the, not just on the threat of the military power, but on the actual use of military power. And we are now in the middle of the largest war in Europe since the end of World War II.
Yeah. Well, you have a chapter on the diverging politics of the two countries in the time after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And you make a really interesting point that you say the Gorbachev era democratic experiment survived in the former USSR's second largest republic, Ukraine. And why was this? It was because of its regional diversity, the weakness of its nationalism, and its competitive politics. So are you essentially saying that it was Ukraine's apparent or obvious weaknesses that actually made it more of a democratic success compared to Russia?
Yes, when you look, and people were, and I was there as certainly witness to some of the events in 1990, at the beginning of the 1990s, there were huge hopes about Russian democracy, right? Yeltsin was it was someone who embodied it. While when people were looking at Ukraine, there was certainly well-grounded concern whether the democracy would survive there. The former communist members of the Communist Party, the leaders of the Communist Party were able to position themselves at the top of the state. The Ukraine was much more conservative in embracing the economic reforms and so on and so forth. But As things started developed in the 1990s and then beginning of the 2000s, it became very clear, even before the Orange Revolution of 2004, that the two countries are on a very different course in terms of their relationship to a rising autocracy and surviving democracy. In Russia, by 1993, Boris Yeltsin, who defended the Russian parliament, the so-called White House in Moscow, against the Soviet tanks in 1991, in 1993, a little bit more than 2 years later, he ordered now Russian tanks to fire at the parliament. A rewrote constitution, created a super presidential republic that became a foundation for the sort of power that Vladimir Putin has today in Russia. When in Ukraine, the elites were trying to emulate what Yeltsin had done in Russia, but eventually realized that they actually couldn't do that. That the population, the people of Ukraine would not allow them to do what people in Russia not just allowed Yeltsin to do, but very often welcomed. And there is a number of explanations to them, and one of them are really different historical trajectories of Russia and Ukraine. Despite not only claims that they're allegedly one and the same people, but also despite some commonalities in history, but quintessentially the history turned very differently for those two groups, and produced very, very different attitude in those groups towards the authority, exceptionally, especially with regard to the right of the authority of the regime, or whatever regime it is, to use violence against their own people. In Russia, it was very difficult historically to imagine almost anything happening without the state, outside the state, or against the state. And the violence legitimized by state was considered to be by majority of the population to be a legitimate one. In Ukraine, you see a situation where Ukrainian project, national project, modern project, came, of course, into existence despite the desires of the state, against the state, and survived in confrontation with the state. So Ukrainian society really had very difficult task ahead of it when Ukraine became independent in 1991. Somehow to learn how to live in a state which is not an outside, which is not a foreign state, not a foreign force, not a force imposed on you, but elected on you. So maybe a distant parallel would be with the United States of America, which came into existence out of general mistrust in the state, and produced eventually, despite all challenges, democracy that continues till today. So in Ukraine, you have the same distrust in the state. And that was, of course, came together with the fact that different parts of Ukraine had different, again, historical trajectories. Ukraine came into existence out of the territory and people ruled by three empires: the Russian Empire, Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And it became clear in 1991 for that state to survive, to go on, one had to reach a compromise. So a different political culture emerged, different from Russia. And when the state was trying to pull a Russian trick and send troops against the people, it didn't end well for the state. The Orange Revolution of 2004 certainly insisted on the fair elections. The Maidan protests that became known as Revolution of Dignity in 2013-2014 chased the president out of the country. When the president, under pressure from Russia, refused to sign association agreement with European Union, and the one of the presidents of Ukraine, the second president, Leonid Kuchma, who refused to follow Putin's advice or demand to use military force against his own people in, during the revolution of Orange Revolution of 2004. He is also the author of the book that is called Ukraine is Not Russian. And according to some accounts, that was exactly the phrase that he used, telling Putin, thank you, but no, thank you, in terms of his advice to use military force. Ukrainians just wouldn't accept the sort of behavior that many Russians embrace, the behavior of the state. And it was difficult to predict that in 1990-91, but then from 1 year to another, from one decade to another, it became very clear that the post-Soviet Russia turned out to be a very different state in comparison to post-Soviet Ukraine. And at the end, it's not just geopolitical orientations of two countries, but also their political systems turned out to be on the collision course, becoming one of the contributing factors to the start of this war.
I mean, you chronicle Putin's many attempts over the past 20 years to tame Ukraine, to really turn it into a nominal independent state, but something that Russia controls or is paralyzed by a super federal system and is neutral. If he could have made that work, do you think he ever would have been satisfied with it? Or ultimately, was this always going to be a pure imperialist project over time?
The war that is going on today didn't start in February of 2022.
Yeah.
It started in February 2014. The beginning of the war was kind of overlooked, or mostly overlooked by most observers outside of the region. And it started over the issue of the association agreement with European Union, Ukraine's association agreement with European Union, something that I just mentioned. Why would Russia annex Crimea, start the hybrid warfare in eastern Ukraine, in the region of Donbass, over the issue of association agreement? It's not membership in NATO. It's not membership in the European Union. It's not even a candidate member status that Ukraine has now, candidate member status of the European Union. And the answer to that is at least for me, quite clear, and that's what I'm trying to say in my book, is that if Ukraine signed association agreement, and it did that, it wouldn't be eligible anymore for membership in the Eurasian Union. And there was a number of versions of that union that Vladimir Putin was trying to propose and impose on Ukraine. So the project was, and the war started outright out of this empire building or rebuilding project, because Putin really followed in the footsteps already of the Russian politicians and thinkers of the early 1990s, where the world was imagined in Moscow, the future world, the ideal world, as a multipolar world, not one dominated by the United States, but multipolar, and Russia was imagined as one of those poles. One part is China, rising China at that time, and one part is the European Union that was in the process of territorial extension. But to become a pole, there was also understanding that Russia would have to re-establish its control in some form. The form was debated and discussed, but in some form, from liberal empire to illiberal empire over the post-Soviet space. And Ukraine, the second largest Soviet and then post-Soviet republic, was really crucial for the realization of that project. So once Ukraine tries to move westward and tries to escape the sphere of influence that Russia considered to be its own, what you get in 2014 as well. So at that point, it wasn't just about joining any Western institutions, at least in the immediate future. It was just about signing an agreement that would keep Ukraine outside of the Eurasian Union. That was at that point already perceived to be unacceptable. So it is a very much imperial project, but it is also, as we know now, had been supported by the form of the Russian imperial thinking that comes from the 19th century, and we discussed that before. So empire and this imperial vision of nation is something that again the Russia tries to implement in different forms. Since the 19th century, how to reconcile the nation and empire, how to keep the 1/6 of the earth that was acquired by the Tsars up until 1917, how to keep it under control of one center, and at the same time somehow find a formula to deal with the global processes of the rise of national state, of the rise of the sovereignty of those states. So we'll just look at over the centuries, look at different ways how they're trying to reconcile empire with nation, and the whatever ideas, whatever models are out there, most of them would lead to bloodshed.
But coming to the full-scale invasion of last year, I mean, it's clear from your book and from other books covering the beginning of the invasion that the Kremlin was shocked that the Ukrainians didn't collapse, you know, within days, as happened in Crimea, as essentially happened in Georgia in 2008, and that Zelensky didn't flee like Yanukovych. It just amazes me. I mean, how is it possible that a country that, as you set out, is two countries that have been so close for so long, how did they misjudge Ukrainian behavior so badly, and how was their intelligence and their spy network so bad?
Well, it's not just the Russians didn't misjudge Ukraine. Before the start of the war, the Washington and European capitals and Moscow disagreed on almost everything. But there was one tacit understanding that Ukraine probably would not survive for more than a few days, maximum weeks. You can see that not only from the way how unprepared for that war turned out to be Russia, really, with the troops marching in Ukraine with the parade uniforms, preparing for a parade on Khreshchatyk, the main street of Kyiv. But also you can see that from the sort of the weapons that the West had been sending to Ukraine reluctantly, with President Trump trying to get political bribes in return for those weapons. But the sort of weapons that were there were weapons for the partisan warfare. So if Ukraine would resist, the biggest optimists in Washington believed at that time it would not be the state that would resist. The best thing for Zelensky would be to flee Kyiv. It would not be the Ukrainian army. It probably would not last for long, but maybe there would be a partisan warfare. And that's sort of the weapons that were sent. So Ukraine surprised in that sense both East and West in terms of its resilience. And one of the explanations when it comes certainly to the Russian side of how you can misread the country so badly is that you become really a hostage, a victim of your own misreading of history and of your own mythology. If you really believe that Russians and Ukrainians are one and the same people, you not only expect that they would not fight back, that it would be just nationalists and drug addicts who would be doing that and a bunch of Nazis, but also that they would react to your use of force in the same way how Russians behave. And misreading of history, that particular type of ideology that we discussed at this point became, at least in my opinion, also crucial reason for misreading Ukraine, for misunderstanding and making wrong predictions in terms of how Ukraine and Ukrainian society would behave, how strong was the state, how strong and determined were the armed forces. And then Russia, and we talked about that as well, is not a democracy. It is autocracy with elements of a dictatorial regime. And in the situations like that, the intelligence services are bringing the boss the information the boss wants to hear. And the boss is very explicit in saying what sort of frame, what sort of ideology, what sort of expectations he has. He publishes articles, he declares speeches. So it's really a case of not only imperial war on the Russian side, but also a case of imperial type of miscalculations and the falsehood of the imperial mythologies.
Yeah, they not only seem to have misjudged people in Kyiv, but they have misjudged people that they assumed were their allies. I mean, you make the point that the most acute victims of this war have been Ukrainians in the east and the southeast, many of whom are Russian speakers, and probably would have been Kuchma or Yanukovych voters. Do you think there are many or any Russophiles left in the Donbas?
Yes, the who suffered the most in this war were exactly the people whom Russia allegedly was supposed to save and liberate. The city of Mariupol that was almost entirely destroyed, or at least half of the city was destroyed. Before the war, 44% of the population were not just Russian speakers, were ethnic Russians, and the absolute majority were Russian speakers. The second largest city in Ukraine, Kharkiv, that is 40 kilometers plus minus from the Russian border, was bombarded and continues to be bombarded for weeks and months. The largest suburb, the largest part of the city, the Soltivka is completely destroyed, and what I read, at least, they say that this is the largest sort of compound of that level in Europe in general. So what you hear now from the mayors of many cities, including Kharkiv, is that the attitude towards Russia became much more hostile than in their opinion, is the attitude of the people in Western Ukraine, who traditionally were viewed as anti-Russian. Western Ukraine was the place where the Ukrainian insurgent army was fighting against the Soviet armed forces and then Soviet internal troops for 6-7 years after the end of World War II. And that resistance, that spirit of resistance to Moscow, to the Soviet Union, of course, normally because of that is associated with Western Ukraine. So now the argument is made that Eastern Ukraine is actually much more determined to fight Russia and maybe other regions. So it's a sad irony that this war achieved absolutely, on that level at least, achieved absolutely opposite to what was declared, and not only declared, but what was, in my opinion, one of the key goals of the war, liberating Ukrainians from alleged nationalists and allowing Russians to be Russians again. That was the vision. The war will have, and already has, a major impact on Russian-Ukrainian relations for generations to come. And if anything, it strengthened Ukrainian Ukrainian national identity that is exclusivist in relation to Russia and certainly doesn't include any elements of Russian identity of today, at least.
Well, today, I mean, Ukrainians are bound to feel very uncompromising, but most wars do end in a compromise. And in many ways, Kyiv has already more than achieved its strategic aims of binding itself to the European Union and NATO, and it's going to be Europe's preeminent military power once the war is over. So can you see any way in which there is a compromise that allows some of these lands, particularly if the people who want to live in Ukraine have probably already come, you know, have moved west, there is any way to settle on something like the pre-February 2022 lines?
Ukraine's position is that Ukraine wants to go back to the its internationally recognized borders.
Yeah.
That means the borders before the February 2014, right? Before the start of the war. I don't think there are any historical precedents where the countries would basically say while fighting the war that our goal is not really to liberate the entire country that was violated. And I don't think that that sort of suggestions could be made to any political leaders of any fighting country. So it's, well, I hear a lot of these questions, and what they basically, what they imply is that, well, we expect from Zelensky a behavior that we would never expect from our own leaders. So that is the first comment. And the second is that since the late March of 2022, and early April of the last year, the negotiation track, and there were negotiations going through March, was really made difficult and completely unacceptable because of the two factors. First of all, the Ukrainians discovered that they could fight and they could fight back. And once they did that, they started to liberate their territories. And then came Bucha and the atrocities committed by Russian troops. And we all know about Bucha, but the liberation of Ukrainian territory continued since March. And there are much more Buchas like that, which really made the negotiation track really, really not realistic for today. We are in a situation since, for at least a year now, where the biggest questions of the war are not decided anymore at the negotiation table. They're decided at the battlefield. And whatever will be the borders of the future Ukraine, they will depend on what happens on the front lines. And I don't think this is something very specific for the current stage of the war or for this war in general. If you look at the relatively recent history and history of the Cold War, and look at the countries divided by borders from Germany to Korea to Vietnam. Again, most of these borders came to existence as of course, an outcome of negotiations and documents signed. The map was decided more than anything else by the movement of the forces. And that's where we are today in Ukraine. The year started with two big questions about the future of the war. Both of them were related to the potential military breakthroughs, not diplomatic breakthroughs. The first question was, what would be the outcome of the Russian winter offensive? And the second, what would be the outcome of the possible Ukrainian counteroffensive. So that was those were the questions on January 1st, 2023. We have now answered to the first question about the Russian military offensive. They didn't get anywhere. We are now awaiting the potential start and then outcome of the Ukrainian counteroffensive. Once we get that those results, I think the entire Ukraine, the front lines, the world would be in a different place, whatever the outcome of it is, with a place which would allow actually to project for the future and think also about military track, things about negotiation track, what would be the relations between them. But in the last year, it is whatever happens on the battlefield decides for now not just military, but also the political situation about around Ukraine.
I think that's a good place to end our discussion of the book. So as usual, because this is a podcast about books, I've asked my guest to recommend a couple, one or two in his field, potentially our personal choice. And I should add that on a previous interview, Ollie Rain chose Nuclear Folly as one of his. So, what have you chosen?
One of them is a recent book that I reviewed for the Washington Post, and it is written by Olga Onuch and Henry Hale, and it is called Zelensky Effect. And I really highly recommend it because it is a book about, of course, President Zelensky, who is a lot in the news now, who sometimes is called Churchill with iPhone, but it's also about the society that produced Zelensky, and it is very important. And another book is not on Ukraine, not on Russia, but certainly betrays my interest as a historian. And the book is by Katja Hoyer, Beyond the Wall, A History of East Germany. And I read it, I blurbed it with pleasure. It looks like it's doing very well in Britain in particular. So it is the history of East Germany, the place that once exists. And without understanding which, it would be difficult to understand today's Germany, including its position in the current war and huge diplomatic crisis that accompanies it. So these are the two books that I think the listeners can really benefit from in terms of understanding what is happening today in Ukraine, but also gaining better understanding historically and otherwise of what used to be Eastern Europe.
Well, thank you. Neither of those have been chosen before. So today I've been talking to Serhii Plokhii about his book, The Russo-Ukrainian War, published by Allen Lane. Serhii, thank you for coming on.
Jim, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much for your questions and for this possibility to present my views on what is happening in this world today.
Thank you.